Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I'm here today with the wine director of the Meatball Shop, Sky Latour. Welcome to the show, Sky.
Thanks for having me,
Joe. I've actually been coming to the Meatball Shop quite a bit since you guys had opened in the West Village, pretty close to Del Anima, and I've been a big fan, so I'm excited to have you on the show. I was actually super stoked when you guys, because at first you didn't have a liquor license at that location, and then once you did, I was very excited. I saw that you put on some really fun wines.
Yeah, we made it happen.
So tell us a little bit about how you got to the Meatball Shop, your experience in the past. I know you grew up in New Jersey, lived kind of around the country, worked at some pretty spectacular restaurants, Emeralds Delmonico in New Orleans, A16 with the great Shelley Lindgren in San Francisco, and you made your way back up to the Northeast Coast, or Northeast. But tell us a little bit about what brought you into the industry and your experience.
I've always worked in restaurants. I started on Route 17 in New Jersey, and I just kind of always worked at a restaurant somewhere or another, in order to pay the bills. And when I moved to New Orleans, I moved there because I was just bored and complacent, and I wanted to be somewhere that was going to entertain me. And I started working as a busser at Emeralds Delmonico because I wanted to learn how to do, you know, the real fine dining, serious stuff, because I'd always done mostly chain restaurants. And I worked for, you know, Alice Cooper in Phoenix, and so I wanted to take it a little more seriously, since that was about 6 years in at that point. And so I worked my way up, and I ended up just lucking out. I had the most amazing mentors. When I showed up at Emeralds Delmonico, Chris Robles was the wine director, and he was really amazing, and he was a rock star to me. And we would do tasting menus, 10 courses every day, and the chefs.
So your idea of starting at Emeralds Delmonico was because you knew you wanted to be in the industry and you wanted to learn the finer side of things. But did you know that you wanted to also go into the wine industry, or was it
No. The
wine side?
I wasn't even a drinker until I was 21. I started drinking when I was in New Orleans, actually.
If you're not drinking in New Orleans, what are you doing there?
Exactly. Well, I played a lot of good pool up until that point. But otherwise, yeah, I just wanted to take restaurants a little more seriously. Mm-hmm. I ended up, you know, when you go to school, you kind of rule out some of the stuff that you don't want to do. And I realized that the restaurants were a constant thing. So I tried to take it more seriously. And then it was just how amazing the wine program was at Delmonico. I mean, that, you know, if I could get that list back, it was incredible. We had, verticals of Jaye and Dunn and everything you could imagine for really reasonable prices. I mean, we would drink, you know, 1990 Jaye Von Romani, you know, after dinner with steak.
Wow.
And it was really nice. And I think, you know, we didn't take it for granted, but I certainly didn't know what I had when I had it at the time. And then after a few years, you know, it's pretty old school there. It's like an apprenticeship almost when you're interested in wine. And I went to Burgundy. I kind of got to that point where you're that snotty sommelier. You think you know everything, but you don't know nearly enough. And I would talk about wine like that to guests, and they were like, oh, so you've been there? And I never actually had been there. So I wanted to kind of put my money where my mouth was and go and check it out, so I knew what I was saying. And so I went to Burgundy, and I went to Italy, and ended up doing the harvest in Burgundy. It was 2003, when it was a really hot vintage. So they had to scramble for pickers, and I kind of lucked out. Ended up staying 6 weeks. And I just kind of, you know, fell into the same same trap that we all do, I guess.
And so what did actually going there and doing Harvest, what did that enlighten for you or change in you?
Well, it took the snottiness right out. you know, it doesn't get realer than those guys. I mean, they wake up every day and think about the weather and the vineyard and the wine and what they want to do and what everybody else is doing and how their previous vintage is doing. And that's, you know, what they think about every second. They take it really seriously. And then you realize how seriously you need to take it. And what all those things mean and what it means to have like a agricultural product as opposed to a beverage sometimes. And it was a big deal for me.
And then you went back to New Orleans after that.
And I try not to be a snob and just kind of keep the confidence. I mean, I didn't realize that knowing Burgundy like I did was such a leg up until I got more involved. And then so I worked at Dials as a captain and an assistant, and then I got my first gig there at a French restaurant in the French Quarter. And maybe 2 months later, it was Hurricane Katrina. So I evacuated to San Francisco, where everybody told me I should have been in the first place. and that's when I met Shelly at A16. Like the first day I arrived, I met Shelly, which doesn't get better than that.
How did you manage that?
I had had my eye on San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's a old boys club in New Orleans. I was kind of like waiting for somebody to die in order for me to get a sommelier gig there. And everybody would tell me, you know, in San Francisco, it's a totally different world, and they welcome more newer faces and things like that. So I had my eye on it for a while. I knew who I wanted to meet and where I wanted to go. And, you know, I went to Rubicon, I went to A16, and I just fell in her lap at the right time.
You just walk in and say, I want to meet you, Shelly?
I met Paul Eibund, and I just walked into Bacar, and then he walked me into Rubicon, and then they told me how there was this person, Shelly, and she's amazing, and she could use help because she's got, you know, people, she can't pop the corks open fast enough. And so they dropped me on her doorstep, and she, you know how she is, she's the most warm and welcoming person. So I met her, we talked for 15 minutes maybe, and she was like, come on.
All right, well, tell us about your time at A16.
I learned everything you could possibly know about hospitality from Shelly. I didn't know a single Southern Italian wine, and you know, it's 100% Southern Italy. There's no easy Tuscan Chianti things to save you. So you are just stuck with the Southern Italy, which is so brilliant because then you can really appreciate it when you're forced to, you know, get out of your comfort zone. And she doesn't really have a regimen. You just learn by watching how great she is, and you just kind of emulate it. And she's constantly tasting and popping things open, and she's so passionate about things that you latch on to the ones that she likes, and then you realize what's so great and beautiful about those wines, and then you kind of get your own personality from there. And she had that really nice balance of, you know, having such a firm fine dining background that you would get that service, but she shed away all of the uncomfortable stiffness. So it's, you know, pretty magic combination.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of my favorite restaurants in the country.
It's just incredible.
An incredible, a warm place, fine dining quality, wine list, fine dining quality food, but fun. And just an awesome, awesome
place. It reminds me of Roberta. Well, Roberta's reminds me of A16 because A16 got there first for me. But yeah, they're very similar in that way. Like, you feel like a real warmth here.
And then what brought you to New York?
At A16, I met Daniel Holtzman. He was the opening chef at SPQR. We were really, really close friends. And he always wanted to open something of his own in New York. He grew up here. And he always used to walk by restaurants in San Francisco and say, why can't somebody just do one thing right? And, you know, eventually he came up with a meatball shop, and he needed somebody to whip up a wine list. And it's, you know, how hard it is to just articulate what you want, and it's great to have people that know what you want without having to explain it. And I know what he wants, so it was really easy. I came here for a weekend, made the list, and he was worried that nobody was going to show up. The restaurant was going to open like 4 days. And he was like, what if nobody shows up?
Yeah, that, he's never had to worry about that.
And he's never had to worry. I mean, he does because he worries about lots of things, but right. he's never had to worry about it, actually. And then they wanted to open more. And while I was in San Francisco, I opened quite a few restaurants from the start. So it was a nice combination of hybrid for me of like a challenge of opening 4 restaurants in 2 years and then also having the ability to do the beverage program at the same time. So there was a nice balance of something I really know and something that would be a challenge.
So tell us about how you approach putting together the beverage program for these restaurants. Is, you know, there's probably more than I'm not thinking of, but obviously the original one, the Lower East Side, mm-hmm. the West Village one near Del Anima, Williamsburg, Upper East Side, Chelsea. Am I missing anything?
No.
All very different neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Do you kind of cater your wine list and beverage programs to the neighborhood?
I try. We're trying to run that line of having consistency and being able to walk into any meatball shop and knowing that they have what you want. And also appreciating that the neighborhood's there. We, you know, it's hard to keep those two things. We tried a few things and failed as far as the beverage goes of catering specifically to different places. But it's a little bit different.
Like what? What can you share with us? It's so interesting.
Like, don't put champagne on a meatball shop wine list in Brooklyn because that won't work. So that would be my main failure. I mean, I always thought that it would be fun to have champagne. And, you know, sometimes when people ask for things, you think it's more people than are yeah. actually there. So it turns out, like, you know, there's actually 2 people that want champagne with their meatballs in Brooklyn. And that is about it.
Yeah. And one of them doesn't realize how much champagne actually costs. They just think yeah. it's sparkling wine, right?
But what's incredible, I found a really beautiful champagne for super cheap. I was able to put it for $40 on the list. And it was well worth more than that. Maybe that was the error too, is when you put it too cheap, people think something's wrong with it. But we like to make sure that the value goes directly to the people eating the balls. You know, we don't, we try not to take too much of that.
Yeah, I mean, the concept is just such a brilliant one. It's hard for me as someone who works in the restaurant industry to just to sit there and enjoy it and not think about how brilliant of a concept it is. You know, not only is it the product absolutely delicious, but it how much it must simplify things to have such a streamlined menu that still gives your customers lots of options and is kind of fun, and who doesn't like a meatball?
Exactly.
It's awesome. Like, it's such a great idea, and kind of a definitely a preferred lunch spot for me in the neighborhood now that I moved to Brooklyn.
Nice.
Okay, and then so what kind of wines do you think go well with meatballs and the fare at the meatball shop?
It's super easy yeah. to find wines that go with the meatball shop. One, because Italian, any Italian-minded food is the easiest food to have wine with. So it's more Italian wines than anything else, but it's a super small list. I mean, there's like 15 wines. But, you know, we also have the things that, in my mind, go with everything. So you've got, you know, Prosecco, Rosé, Beaujolais, and Riesling. You know, we have those markets, vegetables and market salads that are amazing with the Riesling. Mm-hmm. And the veggie ball with pesto and Riesling. It's kind of where it's at also.
Yeah, so pesto is definitely my preferred sauce there. I like the chicken with the pesto.
Mm-hmm.
And the pork with the meat sauce.
That's my winner, I think.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. And so what have been some of the most successful? What are people actually drinking?
People are actually drinking cocktails.
Yeah.
people love cocktails. Cocktails are somewhat new for me, and really, really fun, and exciting. You know, everything that we try and do is to just keep it simple, take things that, you would think are supposed to be complicated and expensive and require a lot of tools and ingredients, and show you that you can do it in a way that it isn't necessary to do that. And cocktails are one that people really appreciate that you do that, and you can then give it to them for a less expensive price because there's less labor and less stuff going on. So that's what people are drinking for the most part. They like cocktails and whiskey and Montepulciano.
Everyone's asking for Montepulciano.
Everybody loves our Montepulciano. It's been on since the day one. I've never taken it off. And it's super delicious, and it's it appeals to so many different types of palates because it's got that like rich, smooth, deep, dark fruit. So you've got like Merlot drinkers and Malbec drinkers and Cabernet drinkers and Grenache drinkers can all kind of jump on the Montepulciano.
On the Montepulciano bandwagon. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more on In the Drink today with Sky Latour.
You are listening to Leaving by Dead Stars on the heritageradionetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from In the Drink.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
We're back with In the Drink today with Sky Latour. Sky, so you run the wine program for, or the beverage program for Five Meatball Shops. I really love the well-edited wine list that you've chosen, and have had several of the cocktails there as well. Well done. But you do have this this background where you told us before that you were drinking 90 Jaye after family meal, and you worked with, you know, an A16 with Shelley Lindgren. Do you ever miss that level of wine service and kind of dealing with those finer wines?
Yes, I do. But, you know, I think it was just, you know, the sacrifice I had to make to kind of move on as a person in the industry. I miss it a lot. But there's a lot of things that I grew frustrated by. You know, you, as a sommelier, you are often in situations where you want to talk about wine, but you can't really speak freely about it. There's always a little bit of a limitation there. Mm-hmm. And the more in love with wine I got, the less interested I was in structure and constraints like that. And so instead of it being sommelier being like a fun game and career to hone in on and get really good with those skills, because there's so many skills that you really have to practice, and just being on the floor is such a difficult thing to do, but if you are in the zone, it's like so amazing. And then there was a point where I was just so interested in, you know, speaking about wine the way I wanted to and showing people things that maybe aren't appropriate when you're in that kind of sommelier to guest situation, that I kind of started wanting a little bit more of a relaxed approach.
Like for what? For what would, like, what would you like to show someone that you couldn't do in a more formal dining setting?
Well, I just think it's hard to, I wish we could speak about wine like, you know, fans speak about football. And, you know, you get really passionate and you opinionated, and sometimes that's not the how you want to present yourself as far as the wine goes, because it's, you don't know where somebody's at, and there's so much tension, and sometimes we're on the other end, and you're inherently the salesperson, and so it's very difficult for them to embrace everything you're saying, no matter how great you are at it. You are selling them a product, and so I just love the freedom of not having that underlying dynamic and being able to deal with wine and deal with people in wine and educating them and talking about it in a way where, you know, that isn't an obstacle.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. Both you and Chef Daniel came from more of, you know, had fine dining experience, and I feel like you guys have both kind of like found your voice and your way through bringing that quality and integrity to a very casual setting, to a very approachable price point. Your wine list, I think the, correct me if I'm wrong, but the most expensive wine I've ever noticed on your list was like our Pipe Rosso, at about $60 and change or something like
that.
Yes, $58, which, you know, I look at that list and like, oh, that's a great price on our Pipe Rosso.
So delicious.
What a tasty wine. But do you feel strongly that wine should be a very good value, that people should be drinking these kind of more approachably priced wines?
Yeah, I feel extremely strongly about that. And that is a big deal to me. I want people to understand that they can drink these amazing wines from these people, these human beings that are making them the wine, and those people actually price their wines at a very reasonable level for the most part, and they're accessible, and the sommelier is supposed to be able to bring those things to you, and most do, but in this light, it's so much more casual and easy, and I can be so more unabashed about it. And a lot of what we do is exactly that. Like, we get frustrated when we see big markups when we go to eat and we go to drink, and we wanted to have a place where we took that away and showed you that you can have something without doing that. I mean, you can't do it in every scenario, but with meatballs, you can.
So how do you go about your selection process? Are you changing your list frequently? Do you have certain criteria? Do you already have, I mean, you have a lot of experience. Do you sort of know which wines you want to put on the list, and you don't need to taste that often?
No, I like to taste all the time. Like you said, it's harder for me now that I'm not in the serious sommelier game to taste as much as I used to. So I like to taste as much as possible. I would love to change the list more often than we do. But for consistency's sake, we stick to maybe 4 or 5 times a year that we'll switch it up. And yeah, I think people sometimes get disappointed when they see me as the buyer there. They're thinking maybe it won't be someone who's such a pain in the ass and has as many requirements as I do, for such a small list, but I do. I need it to be, you know, native varietals, something that you can actually taste what the grape is that was intended. It has to be made from an actual person. And I have to be able to sell it for the price that makes sense. Like, I can't have a rosé be the most expensive wine on the list. It has to be on the cheaper side. So it's really challenging in that way, but I think it's worth it, and it's still fun.
Yeah. How many different distributors do you deal with?
More than everyone would like me to.
15 wines, 15 distributors?
Just about.
Wow.
But more like 8 or 9. It's like there's an awful lot of great wine out here, and there's an awful lot of distributors.
Yeah, and I mean, as a wine geek or someone who has a passion for it, it's hard to not want to constantly taste and see what else. I'm amazed. You know, I've been tasting Italian wine for, for the restaurants for over 6 years now, and there's still new distributors that are coming out. There's new grapes and new appellations that I've never tasted before. It happens all the time, so I can imagine that It takes a lot of self-restraint to keep your list to that size.
You have no idea. It's the hardest part for
but
sure.
But the nice thing about it is, your lists are better than they have to be. They're great. Every single wine on there, I look at it and I'm like, I would like to drink every single wine on here. Maybe it's not what I'm in the mood for tonight, but you know it's a wine that's made with integrity and has a purpose and is a good wine. So I think you've done a great job with
that. Thanks. It's the nicest thing you could have possibly said.
outside of the restaurants, what are you drinking?
God, I love Burgundy. I drink Burgundy a lot. I love it.
Very nice.
And I drink a lot of whiskey. The cocktail side is really fun for me, and I'm still a student in a lot of ways with it. I really have embraced the whole local thing. The fact that all these people are making local spirits reminds me so much of Burgundy, actually. And I want to be able to support that, and we're in a position where we're busy enough that we can, and so we do. And we use mostly local spirits for all our cocktails.
Great. I just brought out a group from the restaurants to the Green Hook Ginsmiths.
Oh, man, he's the best.
He's a great guy.
It's so amazing.
I love it. Like me, he's half Italian and half Jewish and grew up in New York, but boy, does he have the best New York accent.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And just like a year ago, he had his mom on the bottling line. And he put all his information on like a crammed little card. And now he's, full production and killing it. I see his gin everywhere, and we sell like crazy.
Yeah, it's super exciting. What are some other local products that you're really into?
I love Green Hook a lot. I like the 77 Wheat from the Brooklyn Distillery guys. I think they're doing a really great job. And they've kind of gotten the situation where they're not making a full bourbon because they haven't been around long enough to age it long enough. So they make this really beautiful just wheat whiskey, and it's gorgeous. I mean, we use it on our cocktail list to make Ward 8s, and it's really, really delicious on its own. They make a little bit of gin, too. They're pretty great.
Yeah. So going back to your cocktail list for a moment, you said you didn't have a lot of experience when you were putting the list together. How did you go about doing that as someone who didn't have a ton of experience?
At first, we tried to do it very similar to the menu, where you kind of pick your own. So you would pick your spirit, and you would pick your like ingredients, kind of. So we'd be putting like an old fashioned together for you in a way, where you would pick like whiskey, and then you would pick like bitter, and we would make you an old fashioned basically, and things like that. And it got to be a little bit too complicated, but it was really, really fun. But we ended up just kind of using that for the whiskey. And so now we have all these different types of whiskey, and then you pick the type of cocktail. So you can, check off Old Scout, and you can check off Manhattan, and you'll get an Old Scout Manhattan. Or you can do a Whiskey Sour or a Sazerac or something like that.
So a lot of classic cocktails.
Yeah, we like to stick with the classics. And so most of it is just like all of our classic cocktails.
And I like that you're making it relevant to the area that's coming from by using these local spirits and kind of making it a true like New York version of these classic cocktails.
Yeah, and we try and keep it seasonal, so we call it homegrown. So right now the Green Hook we make a Negroni, and that's on our little homegrown cocktail list.
Nice. Can you break any news on the show? Are there any meatball shops opening up anywhere else around?
We want to have another meatball shop, and we have our eye on, hopefully, somewhere in New York for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
To hometown New York boys as well. And, I know Daniel and Michael both from the Upper East Side, right?
Yeah. And, they are chomping at the bit.
It's just an impatient couple. It's a great. I mean, we're rooting for you guys. It's just such an awesome concept, and I love that you're part of the team, and bringing that experience and level of quality to the beverage program. It is awesome. I think that I think they could probably be very successful and not have a true beverage professional hired, but I think it just goes to show like how much integrity that they have, and what a great programming. We're rooting for you.
Oh, that's so nice.
You guys are awesome. I'm sure I'd love to have you back in a year or two when there are meatball shops in Asia and the Middle East.
I'm still gunning for New Orleans.
All right, in New Orleans. And I'll see you back in San Francisco for the La Pole.
Yeah, I certainly will.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure you have a bunch of friends out there that you're going to see as well, huh?
Yeah, I mean, we always have a blast. You know that.
All right, so thank you so much, Skye. It's been so much fun having you on the show, and I'm sure I'll see you at the restaurant soon.
Thanks, Joe.
And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.